This is a reading written by Reverend Lynn Gardner. Can you hear them? Can you hear the whispers of the ancestors? Their stories are in these walls, in our bones, in the air that we breathe. Their stories are in the touch of a calloused hand, in the melody of songs we hum while washing dishes, in remembered faces. We hear the whispers of the ancestors, how their stories touch our lives and call us into becoming.
A little over 20 years ago, a couple of friends and I took a road trip to visit our friend John, who had recently moved down to New Orleans. It was our first time there, all of us, and we did a lot of touristy things. Among other things we did, we heard about these plantation tours that you could go on. Now, we were all Northerners, every one of us, and we were kind of curious about what's this plantation tour thing. I confess, we brought with us a sort of a judgmental attitude. We were prepared to be a little suspicious. But we did decide to go and check it out as part of our Southern experience. So we went. We went to this one plantation. It was called the Oak Alley Plantation outside of New Orleans. And I remember that our guide was a young white woman dressed in 19th century period garb. This, of course, was way before I ever expected to live somewhere where people dressed in period garb are not that big a deal. It was memorable at the time. And I remember she was showing us around the fancy plantation house, and we were in the dining room, and she was telling us about how the servants used to bring the dishes up from the kitchen. And I remember my friends and I were all kind of looking at each other, like, what was this, like, servant thing? And my friend Kate, who was a history major, finally said, do you mean the slaves? And the guide was like, well, it was we call them servants. And she's like, but they were slaves, right? And the guy was finally like, yes, well, the servants, we're going to move on now. And that was the end of that. And I was like, wow, that was so weird. So weird. I had a conversation the other day with Robert Trent Vinson, one of our members here. He told me he had a very similar experience at Monticello about 20 years ago. You know, if you know Robert, you know he's a very calm person. He told me he almost got in a fight with the docent, trying to just make the person say the word slave. I talked to someone else after the early service who said, yeah, that was the experience at Colonial Williamsburg too in the 70s. I guess it's a thing. I didn't know that was here too. So that was really something. But you know, times change and organizations change as well. As I was preparing the sermon, I decided to go take a look at the website of the Oak Alley Plantation. And it seems that since my long ago visit, they have made a change in the way they present the history of that place. Today, their website includes an online research database about all the slaves who lived and worked on the plantation over the generations. And I was very touched by what they wrote as an introduction to this database. I want to read to you what is on this website now. They say, unlike the owners of this sugar plantation, their human property did not leave elegant manuscripts or lengthy letters detailing their experiences. Rather, in what can only be described as bitter irony, the same documents that legitimized their dehumanization, inventories, sales records, are now all that remain to give us hints of their identity as people. So that's a change. At Monticello, things are changing too. I myself visited there for the first time in my life a couple of weeks ago. And it seems that they too have done a lot of work in recent years to tell the story of the enslaved people at Monticello with as much prominence as Thomas Jefferson himself. They're talking about slavery a lot in the house tour I went on. They mentioned slavery a lot in the tours of the grounds and the exhibits. They've just recently, in the last several months, opened up a new exhibit about Sally Hemings and her family. Has anybody seen that yet? It's worth it, I think. Could they do more? Could they do better? Absolutely. In particular, I would highlight the cognitive dissonance I experienced between the museum, which I think is really trying to do a good job, and the gift shop, where it was all like, buy a Jefferson bookmark. You know, so that's still, there's still work to do, right? They are, however, telling the story of that place and of the people who lived there very differently from the way they used to. So why is that? In the case of Monticello, probably the biggest force for change has been the descendants of the Hemings family themselves. We know, of course, now that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, who was an enslaved African-American woman, had several children together. This was an open secret, as you probably recall. It was an open secret in the Hemings family for many years, but for generations, Jefferson's white descendants did not really want to hear about it. They pretty much blew off all the rumors. But then in the late 1990s, you may remember that members of the Hemings family underwent DNA testing that proved Jefferson was indeed one of their ancestors. So there you go. You can't ignore the DNA. So there you go. In 2003, 150 members of the Hemings family gathered at Monticello for a family reunion. You may have heard about this back in that time. That was the first of many family reunions since. And today, Monticello has an exhibit with photos of some of those Hemings family members, video interviews. The whole feel is a celebration of their belonging in that place. The Sally Hemings exhibit, the new one, celebrates her story as well, her strength, her force of character. You remember that she went to France with Jefferson. In France, she was free. Slavery was against the law in France. And so she could have chosen to stay there as a free person. She almost did. She initially planned to stay in France, but Jefferson begged her to come home to Virginia with him. And so she negotiated with him. She was 16 years old at the time. 16 years old. This young woman said to this famous diplomat in his mid-40s, this future president, this 16-year-old said to him, look, I don't have to do anything. I will come back with you if you promise to free every one of my children when they turn 21. She had him over a barrel, and he agreed. He did free those children, his children. Over 200 years later, at that first Hemings family reunion at Monticello, one of those descendants of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, a woman named Patty Jo Harding, had this to say. She said, I think Jefferson is lucky to be related to us. To see what Sally did, she must have been a great woman. Yeah, I think so too. You know, when I was a child, I used to think that whatever was in my history textbooks was exactly how it was. And whoever got their stories told in those textbooks were the people surely that deserved to have their stories told. The important people, right? People who were important enough to have their portrait painted, or even a statue made of them. Historical figures made of stone up on their pedestals. But now our country is in this incredible historical moment of questioning all that, questioning the idea that only a few famous people, mostly white men at that, get to make up this thing we call history. Now we are asking ourselves, whose stories have we not heard yet? Or whose stories have we not fully honored yet? Who are we not seeing when we look up at those stone people up there on their pedestals. And so even these southern plantations, these archetypal institutions of white supremacy, even these institutions are looking afresh at how they tell their stories, what they have left out, what a more honest retelling would look like. And they're doing it because they are prompted by communities who are saying, hello, here we are. And these, in the case of these plantations, primarily communities of color, we know, of course, that the same kind of conversations are happening around gender, around sexual orientation, ability, disability, all the markers that have been used to hold some people down for the benefit of a privileged few. Across the board, communities of people who historically have been left out, who have been saying, here we are and we matter too. Our stories deserve to be told. Our ancestors deserve to be remembered. And we deserve a place of abundance in the world today. What a time to be alive. The way we tell our history matters, doesn't it? It teaches us what is important. It teaches us who matters, not only in the past, but today, right now. When we teach our children, look, these are the heroes of history, we are teaching them about the kind of people we think matter in the world today. And so if we are to take seriously our first principle of honoring the inherent worth and dignity of every person, we had better make sure that our kids are hearing the stories of every people, not just the privileged few. Telling our history is part of the work of justice. And so as we here in this congregation consider what does it mean to be a people of memory, let us celebrate the acts of remembering all around us, remembering, telling our history with care, with deliberation, looking for who has been left out of the story told by the dominant culture, who has not been up on those pedestals. Retelling the story to include and celebrate those people who have been left out, making us all members of the story, just as we are almost certainly members of the human family. This conversation is happening all over. Just look at the Confederate monuments in Richmond. My goodness, the city is wrestling with what to do about them. Take down the statues up on their pedestals or reframe them somehow. Figure out how to tell a fuller, a more inclusive version of what those statues mean. Right here in Williamsburg, the work is happening too. And I want to lift up some work, a really incredible piece of work that our board president, Jessica O'Brien, has done. Jess, where are you? I know you're here somewhere. Where is she? There you are, Jess. Excellent. Thank you. So Jessica O'Brien, in partnership with All Together, has put together an African American history tour of Williamsburg. She's brought together members of the African American community in Williamsburg, historians from William & Mary and from Colonial Williamsburg, to teach anybody who wants to stroll around downtown and learn about the history of the African American community here. I went last week on the tour. It was wonderful. I highly recommend it to all of you the next time it's offered. Hope that'll be soon. Thank you. Many of you are also, of course, familiar with the Lemon Project at William & Mary, right? Yep. We know that part of the history of the college is a long and painful history of institutional racism dating back many generations. So the Lemon Project, named after a man who was enslaved and owned by the college, that project aims, in its own words, to rectify wrongs perpetrated against African Americans by William & Mary through action or inaction. I think most of you know, but it is worth celebrating again, the groundbreaking work that our own Robert Trent Vinson has done on this project. Robert, by the way, is not here today. He is at a family celebration out of state, but still we can sing his praises. He was one of two founding faculty co-chairs on this project. But when we talked about it, he and I, he strongly emphasized that the Lemon Project was not his idea. He did not start it. Rather, it was the students who started it. Along with, we should say, Dr. Joanne Braxton, who was also a member here, and at that time a professor at the college. Robert recalls, and this is about 2010, that there was a felt need to respond to that history of racism at the college, a history that was known and deeply carried in the historical memory of the African-American community here in Williamsburg. A history of the college, first of all, owning enslaved people for generations. And a history of the college president in the 1850s, who in his day was the foremost intellectual defender of slavery in the entire country. That was the president of our college. And even after the Civil War, a long history of hostility to African Americans throughout the Jim Crow years. The unspoken rule was no black students need apply, but they'd be happy to welcome you as a janitor for a cheap hourly wage with no benefits. That we could do. That would be okay. So Robert recalls, even in 2006, when he came to William and Mary as a professor, even then, there was a sense, even in his own family, among young people who had never had a direct interaction with the college, that still, William and Mary was not a welcoming or an accepting place for African Americans. And so, when the Lemon Project began, it was very clear that this could not be only an academic project. It needed to be a project for the community, with the goal of reconciliation and repair of the harm that had been done to the community for years. I was so moved to listen to Robert talk about the way the Lemon Project organizers have reached out to the community over the years, asking people, what would you like this project to be? How would you like us to proceed here? And asking the question that touched my heart deeply, what could we do that would help you feel whole? What would help you feel whole? And so throughout this last 8 years, this has been a community conversation, bringing in members of the local community to share their stories and their histories. The work has been about listening and learning and apologizing, building a new way together. It is a work in progress, and it goes on. I'm thinking of those statues, you know, up on their pedestals, and I'm wondering if it's starting to feel a little lonely up there. These days, it's gotten a lot more interesting down on the ground where everybody else is. You know, in my own college years, there was a hallowed tradition known as the dance circle. Do you know what a dance circle is? So at a party, you go with a group of friends, and you'd form a big circle. That's what it is, dance circle. And everybody would dance together. And I'm actually, as I tell you about this, I'm hearing in my head this wonderful song I used to dance to called Everybody, Everybody. Do you know it? It goes like, everybody, 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 everybody. Yeah, I'm dating myself, but I don't care. You know, that's what it is. So the thing about the dance circle is you stretch out the circle as new people join in. So the circle just gets bigger and there's room for everybody. And every now and then, as you engage in this dance circle thing, someone will go dance out into the middle of the circle and they'll like do their thing a little bit and everybody cheers because you have to encourage everybody, right? And so after a while, they dance back into the circle. Somebody else goes into the center and you have to cheer them too because that's how it goes. There is room for everybody. There is no pedestal in that circle. There is room for everybody to take their turn to be seen and celebrated, room to join in, even for those stone statue people who might just want to come down from their pedestals and join everybody else until it really is the best party in the world. That's the kind of story we can all be a part of. That is the kind of history we need to tell. And so, with thanks to all the ancestors, and all the storytellers who give us hope and give us direction. We say, Amen. May it be so.